I am so excited for another podcast episode. First thing I want to say is that I think it's really freaking cool that you clicked on this podcast and you are deciding to do something for yourself and for your health today. Clicking on a podcast and listening to a full 30, 45 minute episode all about your health with the intention of wanting to better yourself, that is so cool, and you should keep that up because you're gonna thank yourself later down the road. If you think that a friend of yours will also enjoy this episode, then you should 100% send it over to them. Even if you're struggling with one of the things that I'm gonna cover on this week's topic, and you think that some loved person in your life would benefit from understanding it a little bit more, you should send it to them. Let's do a little weekly recap, shall we? Got sick again. You must be like, Emily, you got sick a couple weeks ago. I know. My immune system just isn't really getting the gist of what it's supposed to do. It doesn't really know how to function right now. I got sick with the flu a few weeks ago. I want to say like 4 to 6 weeks ago. And then we have visitors in town. I got sick from them. Now I'm here. Last week I've been out for the count. I'm so sick of being sick. I'm so sick of not having a routine in place. It's just like a little bump in the road, but it's fine. We're back on our feet. We're back podcasting. Elephant in the room. I'm deciding to switch up my scheduling with my podcasts. I'm going to do every other week from now on just because I'm realizing it's kind of a lot, okay? It's kind of a lot of time that and energy that's being taken out of me. And honestly, I can only hear myself speak for so long. I do social media and I do this and I get sick of myself. That's really the only way that I can put it. Plus, I do online fitness coaching, and that takes up a big portion of me. That's what I'm really passionate in, so I want to make sure that I'm putting that first, you know? It's like my child. It's like my baby. I need to make sure I'm putting it first. So I actually feel like I sound like a 40-year-old smoker right now, but I sound like a goose with my cough. It hasn't been pretty. It hasn't been pretty at all. I want to take a second. Okay, I listened to somebody's podcast where they did like a little recap of everything and they used an acronym for it. I forget what it was, but it was something that they've been loving reading, doing, eating, stuff like that. I want to do something like that. In the month of March, my newest obsession and favorite thing to do is getting outside. I'm realizing really the importance of it in the last few weeks. Especially with being sick and not feeling 100% there, it takes a lot of energy, or at least it took a lot of energy for me to get out of the house. But me and nature, we are best friends. And when I get out there, I really understand the importance of it, getting vitamin D, getting sunshine. In the last couple of weeks, I also got my blood work done, which this is your sign. If you have not gotten your blood work done, go get it done, especially if you're a girl. I got a full hormone panel, a full blood work panel, and then I got a vitamin D panel. This is kind of embarrassing. Okay, so I went to the doctor's office to get my blood work, and I guess I didn't really realize how much they were taking. Also, the doctor told me prior that I should be fasting, obviously, but she said no water. So I fasted from water for about 10 hours, also fasted from food for about 10 hours, right? I went and got my blood work done, not thinking about how they were taking quite literally 5 tubes. And she was like, do you faint at all from getting your blood drawn? I was like, no, fully knowing that I will, like I 100% could. I wasn't really thinking about blood specifically. I was more so thinking, I have a history of fainting specifically, like I used to have POTS and all this stuff. But with blood work, it hasn't really been a problem when I've gotten it done in the past. You guys, when I tell you, she took 1 tube and I started to feel faint already. I was like, oh my gosh, I felt so embarrassed because I was like, she's gonna think I straight up lied. She took almost 2 tubes when she needed to have 5. And then I was like, I'm gonna pass out. I'm going to faint right now. So I was like, I'm so sorry, but I think I'm gonna pass out. And she was like, what? And so she was like not really helping me that much. She didn't really know what she was doing, if I'm gonna be completely honest. She was like, okay, just sit down. She just didn't know how to handle when somebody is about to faint, what you should be doing. And I was like, no, I need to lie down. She was like, oh, okay. So I literally took myself, lied on the dirty doctor's office floor, put my legs up a wall, and after a few seconds, it was fine. She went and got me water. And then I hear from this woman, she's like, oh yeah, you could have had water last night. I'm like, the doctor told me not to. Make it make sense. So then I lied on the doctor's office floor for about 5 to 10 minutes, completely embarrassed, and then she needed to get 3 more tubes. Not to mention, when she first started to get the blood drawn, she tried to use a normal sized needle. But the vein in my right arm was not prominent enough or big enough for her to draw as much blood as she needed in the amount of time that she needed to do so. So I was just standing there. She was like, can you hold this? She put a cotton pad over the hole that she just punctured in my skin. She was like, can you hold this? I'm holding this cotton pad over it. And she's going to find a smaller needle. Takes like 5 seconds. So I'm just like standing there or sitting there with just like covering my blood hole. And she comes back. That's when the whole fainting fiasco happens. And then she's like, okay, well, I have to get 3 more tubes. And I was like, there's no way I am walking out this door without getting my full hormone panel. This is what I've been waiting to do for such a long time. So we switched arms. And she, at the end of the day, punctured 3 holes in me when it was supposed to be 1. And she said that it was drawing so slow because of the fact that I did not drink water the night before. And she was like, next time, definitely drink water, because you absolutely, you're just not, the blood is not drawing. You guys, this is your sign. If you get your blood drawn, just remember to drink some water beforehand, because the blood will come out so slow. And if you have to get 5 tubes like me, you're going to be going through hell. It was awful. So I left that day. I got my lab results back, and they came back, and the same woman who doesn't know what she was talking about was on the phone. She was like, yeah, we noticed that your vitamin D was low. Okay, cool. That's really good to know. And then she said, we also noticed your glucose was low. And she like raised this as a concern. And I was like, you understand that I was fasting for 10 hours. I didn't have any water. You'd think that would play a part. And so I was like, okay, can you just give me the lab results? Can I just look at them? So she sent me the lab results. And there were a million other things that I would have talked about first before the glucose situation. I just thought that was kind of common sense. Like, I hadn't had sugar in quite some time. I hadn't had carbs in quite some time. I haven't had water in quite some time. But I looked down the whole list of my results. And this is where being a fitness coach really comes in handy, because I've learned how to read lab results like a boss. And I am not diagnosing myself yet. I still need to go to my doctor. But this is, again, your sign to get your lab results, especially if you've been feeling wonky. The last couple of years, I have just known there is something wrong with me. I need to get it checked out. And I think it's a hormonal imbalance of sorts. I don't really know what, but I'm starting to narrow it down. So I looked on my lab results and I saw that my bioavailable testosterone levels were significantly higher than they should be. It was at like an 8-point region where it should be around 4.2. Or it was 8.2 and it was supposed to be around 4. There was some abnormality in my red and white blood cell counts. Obviously, abnormality in my glucose, it wasn't that off, but it was off enough where it could possibly raise a concern. Vitamin D deficiency, and there was a couple other things as well. And I was like, what does this sound like? And then also considering that I have struggled and still struggle with hormonal acne, it sounds like PCOS to me. It sounds like PCOS. I don't deal with hair growth or an excess amount of it. And you know what I said? When I went to the doctors to get my lab, or at least the prescription for it, I told her, I was like, over the last couple of years, I've been thinking, I think I might actually have PCOS, but I'm not totally sure. I want to get an ultrasound. And she was like, she completely wrote it off right away. She was like, no, typically people who have PCOS are a little bit more overweight. You'll see hair growth, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, okay, some women are, but not all. I know so many girls that I coach, they have PCOS, and I've worked with them and I've seen the symptoms firsthand. And not everybody experiences every single symptom to the nth degree. Can you guys even listen to this right now with my voice sounding so raspy? Anyways, so I was like, oh, okay. So then I got my lab results back and now I'm like, to me, it looks like it, but I could be wrong, obviously. I'm going to go find a gynecologist, which is always a struggle. If you're a girl, you know, finding a gynecologist after you've moved is such a struggle. I want somebody that I can trust. I want somebody who is not a man. Like, I'm sorry. I don't know how you girls do that. If you're going to a gynecologist who is a man, how? No, I can't do it. And I want to get an ultrasound. I will keep you updated, but the little light bulb in my head is going off after I got my lab results, and I'm very interested in seeing what I figure out in the months to come about my hormone health and health in general. Anyways, this is your sign to get your lab results and get a second opinion as well, not just your doctor who looks at it, and learn to read your labs. That is huge. Anyways, today I'm talking about something that's super fun, super interesting, myth busting when it comes to fitness and health. We're talking about a huge variety of things today, and I think a lot of you are going to benefit from it. I've even benefited from a lot of the research that I did for this podcast episode specifically. I'm basing every single point off of scientific studies that I have researched myself, and if I'm not lazy, I will cite them in the description below, but I might be too lazy to do that because there are a lot of studies. So let's talk through some hot topics that I've been seeing on social media nowadays. So the first one is that lifting weights makes you bulky. Now, you might think, oh, this was just completely busted, this myth, years ago. No, well, it's resurfacing now. Girls are coming on TikTok and saying, real talk, lifting weights did make me bulky and all of this stuff, when they're just trying to get fast views, in my opinion, and they're just like not really actually thinking as to why that happened and actually educated their viewers. There was one person that went on TikTok and the video got a couple million views, and a lot of people have stitched it who are actually educated in this realm. And she was like, something that nobody wants to talk about is that how lifting weights did make them bulky. My upper body became so bulky from lifting weights. And then she went on to say that she lifts upper body 4 to 5 times a week. 4 to 5 times a week. Of course that's gonna happen. Are you kidding? I have never lifted upper body to that volume before, but I do just want to make things clear for you guys. My back is hurting. I feel like a capital C right now. That's what my posture looks like. To make things very clear for you guys, it's not picking up a dumbbell that's going to make you bulky. It's the amount of fat that you burn on, or that you gain on top of your muscle. I have, in my years of lifting, felt a little bit bulky, felt a little bit fluffy, just because I gained some excess adipose tissue, aka fat. It kind of just makes sense. You feel a little bit fluffy. So this, though, if you just lose the fat that you gained on top of your muscle, you're not going to feel bulky anymore, especially if you're strategic with how you are doing, what you are doing in the gym, how you are performing in the gym, and the variety of workouts that you're doing, and the balance between lower body and upper body, etc. Like, if you completely neglect your shoulders and you only train biceps, you're going to have a big bicep and a pretty typical shoulder, right? If you, or in some people's cases, your coach is good at programming, you're going to program something that's a little bit more balanced, right? So no, lifting weights is not going to make you bulky. In fact, it's actually very necessary for women specifically when it comes to bone density. You guys, you know that after a certain age, you are losing bone density by the year, in addition to losing muscle by the year, and you want to do everything you possibly can to maintain the amount of both of those things as much as it is possible. Not because of looks, but because as you get older, it's going to be harder to build and maintain muscle, first of all. Second of all, do you want to pick up your groceries by yourself, or do you want to have your 35-year-old son do it for you? There are so many women out there too that are like super independent now. Watch yourself be independent when you're 85 years old and you can barely get up the stairs. So yeah, get yourself in the gym now so you'll have to thank yourself later. But does that mean that you should neglect other forms of exercise? No, and I'll get into that a little bit more in the episode. Number two, cortisol makes you gain weight. This is a fun one, okay. Whenever we hear cortisol, we want to run away right away. But do you ever consider this? Cortisol is essential, especially when it comes to regulating bodily functions, including your metabolism and your immune response. You just want to be able to maintain your cortisol in a healthy range. But don't think cortisol and think the devil. Think cortisol and it has a purpose. We just have to make sure that we are benefiting our health so that way it's a healthy range. The same is with every other hormone. The same is with your progesterone, your estrogen. Now listen, there is one thing that I want you to completely understand when it comes to, you know, you have higher cortisol levels, you figured that out already, and now you're gaining weight. Why is that happening? It does come down to a simple thing, and that is appetite increase. This study that I'm specifically referencing investigated the relationship between stress-induced cortisol levels and eating behavior in women. The results suggested that stress-induced cortisol released was associated with increased appetite, and specifically with a preference for high fat sugary foods, which in turn typically they hold more calories, they're more calorie dense foods. So while this study didn't directly measure like fat storage or anything like that, the findings support the idea that cortisol can influence in eating behavior in a way that may lead to increased fat accumulation, particularly visceral fat, which if you didn't know what visceral fat is, it's the layer of fat that you have underneath your stomach, which gets kind of gross. But So basically, people with increased cortisol can see an increase of appetite. You eat more, you're in a calorie surplus, you're gaining weight. In addition to, you know, heightened cortisol can do things to your energy levels as well. So you might not be moving around as much. Therefore, you might not be burning the same amount. So if you're eating and then you're not burning the same amount per day, it can lead to increased weight gain. But don't think that stress means fat. Being stressed does not necessarily mean that you're going to be fat. In fact, people are nowadays are always like, reduce your stress, decrease cortisol levels. What if you don't need to reduce stress? What if you shouldn't reduce your stress? Reducing stress can help with your cortisol levels, absolutely. But other factors like your diet and your sleep also helps and influences your cortisol production. And also, a lot of people are obsessed with lowering your cortisol levels. A lot of studies do suggest that overly low cortisol levels can be detrimental. This is why I think social media can be very helpful, but then also very dangerous, because we're obsessed with these low-impact, cortisol-friendly workouts, which don't even get me started. When in reality, that does not apply to everybody. So just be careful about, you know, what applies to you and what you're listening to versus what actually doesn't need to be saturated in your brain. Managing your cortisol levels obviously is super important, but our body is meant to go through a variety of stressors in life, which is why it's actually really incredible to put our body through stressful workouts. Not all the time, obviously, but you know what I mean. Is protein bad for your kidneys? This is a fun one. All right, we're looking at a study that reviewed the literature on a high-protein diet in relation to kidney health. The authors concluded that there is no evidence, zero, to suggest that high protein intake is detrimental to kidney function in healthy individuals. You know what's crazy? People hear this one blanket statement, kidney is bad for protein, or what? Protein is bad for kidneys. And they don't even look into why, and then they just believe the headlines. You know what's insane about the studies that were done? They were done on people who already had pre-existing kidney issues. Duh. So no, eating protein is not bad for your kidneys. Please eat your protein. Actually, it's vital. It's so important. People a lot of the times associate protein with bodybuilders and being jacked up and muscly. Protein is so important for hormonal function. It's important for energy regulation, which that is honestly a topic that I think I want to do a whole entire podcast episode on energy specifically. I'm reading a book right now that has opened my eyes to energy production and how energy is actually created in the body. And there are some vitamins and minerals that you're probably not having enough of in your diet that is leading to chronic fatigue. I was dealing with chronic fatigue, and I had a client that was dealing with chronic fatigue. Every single time she went to a doctor, her doctor told her just that she was iron deficient, etc. I was like, send me your lab results. I'm not a doctor, obviously, so I'm not going to prescribe anything to you, but I can give you general advice that I see. So I saw that her magnesium levels were low in her food log, and I could also pay, and I also paid attention to a few vitamins and minerals such as copper, which, yes, our bodies need copper, were very low. So I was like, I'm going to tell you to eat a few things, because she wanted to do it holistically and not take supplements. Let's see how your energy is. So far, her energy has been on a constant incline through just a few small things that we changed in her diet. I'm not trying to say anything, but I feel pretty dang proud of fixing that. But anyway, I honestly don't even remember what I was saying before that. I think I was just talking about how protein is vital for a lot of different things. Yeah, eat your protein. Okay, moving on. Intermittent fasting. This is one that I thought was debunked a while ago too, but I did have a client sign on with me, and she was like, I don't eat until noon. And I was like, okay, why? And then she was just like explaining that she thought intermittent fasting was better. She was doing like a 16-hour fast, yada yada, but she was miserable while doing it. And I was like, okay, well, let me tell you the facts, and then you can decide if you want to continue this. So people say that intermittent fasting can have an effect on weight loss. This can be true, but not because of why you think. Having an eating window and then not eating window is not going to directly impact your weight loss. What is impacting your weight loss is that you are quite literally shortening the time span of which you can eat. So of course, it's going to be easier to eat less in that window. For some people, it gets dangerous because you are now making it a very big ratio between eating and not eating window. So now when you're allowed to eat, you want to eat everything, right? But I want to talk about intermittent fasting, not on weight loss specifically, but how it can affect women's health specifically. We're leaving men out of this because men and women have different anatomy. So everything that I'm saying, just please only attach it for the most part to women. Because intermittent fasting is one thing that, you know, we haven't seen any negative effects in science and data to men, but to women we have seen negative effects specifically because of hormone function. So the study and research suggest that intermittent fasting may potentially have damaging effects for women due to its impact on hormonal balance and reproductive health. A more detailed explanation, I can put it in a nutshell. I had my notes here. But with women's hormones, particularly estrogen and progesterone, they play crucial roles in reproductive health and overall well-being. So some studies suggest that intermittent fasting can disrupt delicate balance of these hormones, which may lead to irregular menstrual cycles, hormonal imbalances, potentially fertility issues in women. Metabolic adaptations, which if you don't know what a metabolic adaptation is, it basically means what it sounds like. It's where your metabolism adapts to something that you do for a long period of time. So women's bodies may respond differently to fasting than men's bodies, like what I was saying before. Some research indicates that women may be more prone to metabolic adaptations that can negatively affect energy expenditure and fat metabolism, potentially leading to difficulties in weight management. Because if you eat a tiny, tiny, tiny bit amount for a long period of time, and then life happens, and you eat a little bit more than the 1,000 calorie number that you were eating prior, you're going to gain weight. It's going to be hard for you to manage your normal weight because you were eating the amount that a lizard eats per day. Why did I think of a lizard? Why did that come to my brain? Okay, in addition, stress response. Intermittent fasting can be a stressor on the body, leading to increased cortisol levels. Haha, what we were talking about before, which can further disrupt hormonal imbalance and potentially contribute to negative health outcomes, including weight gain and metabolic dysfunction. So basically what's happening is that you are restricting yourself to a very specific time that you are allowed to eat or window. Your body says, no, I don't like that. And then your cortisol levels go all out of whack. That's now another thing that you need to learn to manage. What did we learn before? That cortisol levels can increase appetite, not in all women, but in many. And you can gain weight, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then the last that they covered in this study was nutrient deficiencies, that intermittent fasting may increase the risk of nutrition deficiencies, especially in women who are already at risk to factors like pregnancy. Oh, I mean risk due to factors like pregnancy, breastfeeding, or an inadequate dietary intake. Like what they're trying to say is that you're already giving out some of your nutrients to something else when you're either pregnant or breastfeeding, or you are also missing out on nutrients if you're not eating the amount that you're supposed to be. So obviously nutrient deficiencies is not something that any of us want to have. A lot of us naturally are, like for instance when I got my lab results back and I saw that I was low on vitamin D, that's something that I have to work on. A lot of women are low on magnesium. I talk about this I think every single episode actually because I'm so passionate about it, but we don't really realize that we're magnesium deficient, and magnesium is vital for energy production. So anyways, the study kind of covered so much, but all in all, intermittent fasting, if done to an extreme, can 100% have negative impact on women. Honestly, anything to an extreme when it comes to women and our hormone health, even exercise, if you're trying to get pregnant in the future, it's just not something you want to risk. Next myth is that knees over toes with working out is bad. No, it's not. And anybody who knows any basic program design will understand this. Now, I'm talking for general population, but you hear a lot of people saying when you're squatting and if your knees go over your toes, they're like, oh, that's bad, don't do that. I'm not talking about squatting specifically. Now, when it comes to squat form, it's going to look different on everybody because if you're shorter, taller, wider, your hips are wider. Everything plays a role in what your squat form will look like, but I'm talking in general. There are specific exercises where knees over toes is actually crucial. For instance, front foot elevated split squat. I program these a lot. It is a quad exercise. Whenever you have a quad dominant exercise, a lot of the times when it's a knee flexion based, like a split squat, like a squat. Knee flexion is when your knees are bending like a lunge, right? Knees over toes is actually vital because that is going to bias your quad muscles. So no, knees over toes is not bad. Heels elevated dumbbell squat or barbell squat. Those are two other exercises that are programmed for a lot in order to bias your quads. Heels elevated squat on the Smith machine, only if it's angled though.
oh, I feel congested.
Can you guys like rate this episode and this podcast because of the fact that I'm doing this when I'm sick? And I'm also sweating in this room. No, I'm not complaining. I'm fine. It's fine. I'm fine. Anyways, point is, if your coach programs something that's knees over toes, it's not a bad thing. It's actually really great. But just make sure that you're doing that when it's needed, when it's wanted. For instance, if you're doing a rear foot split squat and it's supposed to bias your glutes, you don't want to do knees over toes. It's going to be a bit of a different form correction. So running causes inflammation. I'm going to laugh. I saw a trainer. I wanted to throw up. This is girl. I'm not going to say her name because I feel so bad. I really like her. I follow her on Instagram and TikTok, and sometimes I just don't know. Somebody's looking in my window right now. Oh my gosh. Somebody just walked past my window, was looking in my window, but then I actually think he was looking at a squirrel and he started waving at the squirrel. Anyway, this one girl, she posted it on her Instagram, something along the lines of how you shouldn't run because it causes inflammation. When I saw that, I was like, please don't discourage girls from wanting to run and start their running journey. Because running is so incredibly beneficial for a myriad of reasons. It's not for everybody. And if you want to get your cardio in, you can get your cardio fix without doing running, of course. But I wanted to debunk this and kind of just state the truth on this. Whether or not you are a runner, this is good to know. So let's talk through it. So this review discusses the impact of exercise on immune function, including its effect on inflammation. So the authors highlight that while acute bouts of exercise can lead to temporary inflammation as part of the body's natural response to stress, regular exercise can have anti-inflammatory effects on by modulating the immune response and reducing chronic low-grade inflammation. So regular running and other forms of aerobic exercise have been shown to reduce levels of inflammatory markers such as C-reactive protein, interleukin-6, which if you don't know what either of those are, just quite literally you don't have to worry about it, but those are inflammatory markers in your body. These inflammatory effects are thought to be one of the reasons why regular exercise is associated with a lower risk of chronic disease, such as cardiovascular disease, diabetes, certain types of cancer. You hear that? Running won't make you fat. Running won't make you bloated. You're fine. You ever come back from a run, you feel like you're going to throw up at first, or you're just not hungry at all, and then 30 minutes later, you're starving. You are ravenous. Yeah, that's because your body is naturally reacting to the stress that you just put it through by becoming a little bit more inflamed, a little bit more knotted up in the stomach. But 30 minutes later, it's going to be like, oh, we're good. Oh, we're Gucci. We're living. We're thriving. We're fine. Hunger goes up and you go crazy because you're like, what the heck? I wasn't hungry 30 minutes ago. Well, now I am. This is why, by the way, if you're a runner, it's important to pretty much immediately fuel yourself, especially if you're somebody who wants to manage your weight and you don't want to gain or lose weight and you want to just really make sure you're on top of everything. I usually say get something in your stomach right after a run, even if you're not hungry, because then later on you're going to go crazy if you don't. But anyway, that just debunked it. Don't be scared of running because it causes inflammation. It does not, long term at least. In fact, I guess it's shown to decrease along with other forms of exercise. So again, if you're not a runner, you don't like it, you don't have to run. But anyways, staying on the running topic, a lot of people associate running with losing weight. I want to talk about that. I think that this has kind of been debunked by other people, other professionals in the industry time after time, but I want to talk about it. And I want to talk about my own experience. So a couple years ago, I did a half marathon. Longest I've ever run, will be the longest I ever run. I want to do a full marathon soon. Maybe in 2025. Anyway, I digress. I started the half marathon because I wanted to challenge myself. I wanted to become overall fit and I wanted to be very well-rounded, which I think is very important to this day. And at first, I went into it and I was kind of like, I do kind of want to lose a few pounds. Stupid. When you're running that kind of distance, you cannot have weight loss on the top of your head. You are going through so much mentally and physically when you are running that kind of distance. And in order to fuel that kind of distance, you don't only have to fuel before, you don't only have to fuel after, you have to fuel during your run. And you have to fuel with a lot of carbs. Now, carbs don't mean weight gain, but excess calories do. I didn't gain weight when I was on my running journey. I was pretty much cutting it at maintenance, which is totally cool and it's honestly what should happen. But if you're trying to run for weight loss, just don't, especially if you want to be good at what you're doing. You will become a fitter individual overall, heart-wise, in every which way. But if you want to lose weight, you don't need to run. You don't need to do any specific kind of cardio. Kind of rule of thumb, number one on the list is obviously being in a calorie deficit. Number two on the list is weight training. Weight training is very important, and resistance training very important for a myriad of reasons for different kinds of people. People who want to gain weight, maintain weight, lose weight, whoever you are, you should be first and foremost prioritizing resistance training. But obviously, just like your quads are a muscle, your heart's a muscle, so you want to work that muscle. So you should obviously bring in some cardio as well. So this can come in different forms, though. I've recently been liking spin classes. Super fun. Makes me want to die, but super fun. I'm getting so hot, but we're at number six. It's a sauna in here. Number six, Pilates is better than weightlifting. Let's talk about it. Oh my gosh. This has been driving me bananas for the last few months. People are like, do Pilates to look toned and long and lengthened and all of this crap. First of all, if you've ever heard or used the term that Pilates lengthens your muscles, please stop. No kind of exercise is going to lengthen your muscles. What does that even mean? I know what you're trying to say, but no. You might be a little bit surprised about what I've concluded with this one. And I wanted to throw it in here because I feel like my take is a little bit different than some other people's takes on the internet. So this study that I'm referencing, I forget when it was done, but who cares? We are comparing specifically Pilates versus weightlifting. And now we are looking at a few different things. Trunk strength, endurance, flexibility in sedentary female adults. That's what the study covered. The results showed that both Pilates and weightlifting led to significant improvements in all three of those categories. However, who is better with flexibility? Pilates. Who is better with trunk strength and endurance? Weightlifting. What am I trying to say? If you want to be well-rounded when it comes to strength, endurance, and flexibility, do both. I think that's so important to have a variety of abilities when it comes to your fitness journey and your fitness capability. I do both Pilates and weightlifting and cardio. Those are my three pillars. Also, though, if you don't like Pilates, there are other ways to get your flexibility in. Like, just do some mobility before a workout. Make sure that you're stretching. That's the thing. I think a lot of weightlifters, they neglect stretching. They neglect all of that kind of stuff. They neglect mobility within their actual lifts. And that is all really, really important. So what am I trying to say? Neither of them is better, but they both help in different ways. And they both will feed different areas of your life. Have you ever heard this person on the internet, you don't need a calorie deficit to lose weight? Have you ever heard that being said? Okay, well, I'm gonna debunk this right now. Just give me literally 2 minutes and I will tell you why this person is wrong. So I'm referencing a study as well with this one. I could just say it with my own words, but I want you guys to have the actual science. This study used mathematical modeling to quantify the relationship between energy balance and body weight changes. The results, we showed that a sustained energy imbalance of 7,600 calories is required to cause a 1 kilo, which is like 2.206 or something like that, pounds, change in body weight, highlighting the importance of a caloric deficit for weight loss. Now, while there are other influences when it comes to how you look after weight loss is done, for instance, the proportions of your macronutrients, if you lose weight but you were only eating carbs and fat and like 20 grams of protein a day, it's gonna have an effect on how you look, how toned, quote unquote. That should be another myth, but I think we all know that toned isn't actually a thing. It's just a term, but anyway. Basically, what I'm trying to say, for weight loss specifically, calorie deficit is a fundamental principle. And then what comes second is composition of diet, macronutrient distribution, obviously individual metabolic differences. So one person who weighs 125 pounds could be in need of a different, completely different caloric range than the other person next to them who could be 126 pounds. Literally, basically no difference. But one person could hold more muscle mass than the other. One person could have adopted metabolic adaptation where they have been eating 1,200 calories for the last 5 years. And now if they eat even 1,300, they gain weight. Another fun weight loss myth, reverse dieting. Have you heard of reverse dieting? If you have, you've probably heard of these quote-unquote case studies, I'll call them that for lack of a better term, where you'll see one person, at first they were eating 1,400 calories a day, they were overweight, they were this, they were that, and then they lost weight over time, and now they're eating more. So eat more to lose weight. Like, it gets confusing. People on the internet are like advocating for calorie deficits, which is the true science, but then they're like, eat more to lose weight. And you're like, what are you talking about right now? Why are you being so confusing? I shall explain. So reverse dieting is very important for a lot of women, especially people who have dealt with metabolic adaptation, who are eating, you know, a very low amount of calories that need to build up to a higher maintenance calories without gaining fat. Reverse dieting is done over a period of like 6 to 8 to 12 weeks, depending. And basically what happens is that you monitor your maintenance calorie intake that you're eating without gaining weight. For a lot of people, it would be a very small number, like 1,200, 1,300 calories. And then week by week, you slowly increase calories by 50 to 100 calories. And then metabolic adaptation, your metabolism adapts to what you're doing. So that way, if you're doing it very slow and you're increasing calories very slow, you won't gain weight over time. Now, we have people who get us confused by saying that you will lose weight if you eat more with reverse dieting. I shall tell you why this is, because most of the people and the clients that they're doing this on was eating 1,300-1,400 calories every single day throughout the week. And then on the weekend, they're binging and they're eating at restaurants and they're getting, you know, ice cream and calorie dense foods, which isn't bad. It's like fine. But when they went to this fitness coach, they were probably like, I'm only eating 1,300-1,400 calories. And the fitness coach was like, oh my gosh. So they put them on 1,400 calories and they increase them to 15, then 16, then 17 over a few weeks' time. And then once they're on this plan, the clients are now adhering and they're not during the weekend going to get their super calorie dense meals. They're not eating 3,000 calories on the weekend on a Saturday. So now their weekly average of calories is much lower than it was before. And they were actually in a calorie deficit when they were reversing because of the fact that they were not eating that crazy amount over the weekend. So they weren't reversing. They weren't eating more and losing weight. Because if you take it with weekly averages instead of daily, you will understand that. Reverse diets are really important for a lot of people, but I just think it's important to understand why it gets confusing when people are like, eat more to lose weight. No, it's truly not how it's going to work. My last myth, which I think is going to hit home for some girls, the myth that wanting to change or wanting to lose weight is a bad thing. This is completely opinionated right now. I'm not basing this one off of a study or anything. I think that body positivity, that movement, has actually done us wrong in the sense that it has allowed for complacency to enter our lives. I think it's amazing to be able to look in the mirror and appreciate the work that you've put in, what you have done, and to think that you are and be appreciative of what you look like. Because every single human being has been created in such a unique way that nobody else has. And I truly think that there is beauty to every single human being. So it's important to think that of yourself as well, you know, without getting like egotistical about it. But body positivity, I think, has taken us from a place of being appreciative of what we look like and who we are, and then always striving for greater and more because we care about our bodies so much, to looking in the mirror, feeling overweight, feeling lack of energy, feeling gross, and being like, oh, well, it's who I am. I'm beautiful just the way I am. I need to love myself more. Have you ever thought about the fact that loving yourself more actually means taking care of yourself as well? Because if you, let's say you have a daughter and your daughter is dating a guy and he cheated on her, but she's going to get back together with him or she's going to stay with him. What would you tell her to do? You'd say, girlfriend, you're dumb. Don't do that. If we stick with this narrative of self-love, like the way that society, I think, teaches us right now, it's void of truth. We're not going to not tell our daughter to do the right thing because we love her so much. To not tell her to make that decision would be not love, right? So I think the same is with us and with our bodies and how we treat ourselves. When it comes to the body positivity movement and what it altered in our brains, is that we're looking in the mirror and we're saying, love yourself more through these self-help practices, but are we actually telling ourselves the truth? And the truth might be, I'm learning to be so appreciative and see the beauty in me that God has given me, right? but to be untruthful with myself and to say that I'm healthy right now and I'm giving my body what it deserves, that would be void of love. I would actually not be loving myself. I think that's something to think about, and I think it's just important in every aspect of life, in every season of life, no matter what your age is, no matter who you are, to never be complacent with what you have. Always strive for a little bit greater, a little bit greater, a little bit more. And it doesn't mean that you always have to be achieving these insane goals. It's just kind of like, I don't know, if you get an acai bowl and you ask for them to add bee pollen and some cacao nibs and maybe some honey on top, maybe some chia seeds as well. Those little tiny little sprinkles of health is going to help you so much. And it's kind of like the same with wanting to be better and be better. Just add a little sprinkle of chia seeds into your life, right? Add a little sprinkle of bee pollen into your life by wanting to become 1% healthier and 1% better of a human being, whether that be healthy with your brain, healthy emotionally, healthy physically. Obviously, it's going to look different in every season of your life, but to be complacent and to just quote unquote love yourself is not love. Just remember that, I guess. Love without truth is void. Truth to yourself. Be true to yourself. Not in a woo-woo way, but instead of being complacent and staying the way I am, I'm going to be truthful with myself and like give myself that hard discussion of, am I really healthy right now? That was one of the things that really helped me when I first started my entire journey from being underweight to then being overweight and losing 50 pounds to even now. Like every now and then I go through seasons where I don't feel my healthiest. I'm not making the best decisions and I'm looking in the mirror and I'm saying, I don't feel my healthiest right now. I need to get myself back in line. It happens to the best of us. And it's come with the territory of caring for your health. You're always going to be taking two steps forward, one step back. It's going to be a graph that is so up and down, but overall, prioritizing looking after your body and your health, your mental health, emotional health, all aspects of your health, so beneficial. If there are any episode ideas that you want me to cover on the podcast, please let me know. I think there's a little thing that you can add comments to this podcast in Spotify. You should do that. But I really enjoyed myth busting with you today. If you have any questions about any of the topics that I covered, I would absolutely love to talk them through with you. You can DM me on Instagram or on TikTok. And in addition, I post so many little tips and tricks when it comes to your health and myth busting and all that kind of stuff on both of those social platforms. So you should follow me there. Rate this podcast if you haven't already because it helps me so much and it makes me want to keep on going. And then I will catch you next time on Girls Gone Healthy.